From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Netflix will now release some of its movies in theaters before they appear on the streaming site. What's behind the new strategy? Then Rami Malek, the star of the new movie Bohemian Rhapsody, explains how he found a connection with the supremely unique Freddie Mercury with a set of giant false teeth.
The teeth were something, that was a first moment when I thought, oh, I never thought I looked like him, but this is going to help. It was something that Freddie was very insecure about, and I wore them from day one. I felt insecure, but I felt a little bit closer to him.
All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. There's one movie this fall that I'm really eager for film fans to see. It's Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. When I saw it on the big screen at the Telluride Film Festival, I did think that it would be a shame that most people would end up streaming it on Netflix rather than seeing it in theaters. Yes, this Oscar-winning director's personal movie about a year in his childhood is a Netflix release. It's also a cinematic feat, shot in black and white without a score, but instead with an intricate sound design. It unfolds like a dream memory. Well, this week, Netflix announced plans to buck its past practices and will release Roma exclusively in theaters before putting it out on the streaming platform. Granted, it'll only be in limited theaters in a couple of big cities for a few weeks. To discuss the move, I Skyped today with Kyle Buchanan, an awards expert at the New York Times.
They're trying to have their cake and eat it, too, with this theatrical window. Alfonso Cuarón is demanding, you know, big screens and big sound systems. And Netflix is essentially sort of paying for those. I don't know how it will do financially. I don't even know if Netflix will tell us how it will do financially. They're not usually in the spirit of giving figures out like that. But, you know, I mean, it's ironic to me that Roma, which is a very patient drama, in fact, one that opens with, I think, about a 2-minute unbroken shot of cobblestones being washed, is debuting on a service that has a skip intro feature.
I don't think it's even 2 minutes. I think it's closer to 3 or 4, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the cinematography and the sound design of this film are extraordinary. So what do you think Netflix is really doing? Because it's not just Roma. It's a couple other movies they're going to give limited theatrical releases to. It probably is not going to have much upside financially because it costs a ton of money to release a film theatrically. And if you're only doing it in a handful of cities for a limited amount of time, you're not going to get much payback financially.
I mean, I don't think Netflix has ever been in a penny-pinching mode. They're spending to try to take over everything. They have essentially transformed television irrevocably. They want to do the same for movies, you know. I think even prior to Netflix, we were wondering how much longer the traditional theatrical window would last. There were a lot of incursions into that from, you know, shrinking home video releases, Redbox. There were studios and Hollywood figures who tried to get day-and-date debuts on a sort of direct-to-video platform. But Netflix represents probably the strongest threat in many Academy members' eyes to that hierarchy. The idea that a movie has to come out in theaters to be considered a movie, to be considered an Oscar contender. Up until now, Netflix has argued that that's not the case, that the movie can come out on a streaming service with just the most obligatory rule-following booking in a couple theaters to warrant Oscar consideration. Now, though, they're hedging. They're hedging on their bets somewhat. I think with the notion in mind that if they can at least get a Best Picture nominee, then it will have been worth it because that will only draw more people to Netflix. And by people, I mean filmmakers and actors.
And I think it's important to note that these are really token theatrical releases. They're only a couple of weeks, only in a couple of markets. So it's not a meaningful theatrical release. Why would Netflix do something in such a limited manner, or are they really unable to do anything more broadly because the big chains won't book their films?
Well, it's both. Yeah, they can't do it more broadly. Those theatrical distributors, there's only a few types of theaters that will play ball with Netflix, knowing that their window will be undercut by a debut on the streaming service. So that limits them somewhat, that the spend limits them somewhat, but they consider it an investment that they're willing to make, because if it gets them a Best Picture nominee, that's something you can't take back. If it gets them a Best Picture winner, I mean, all bets are off.
It's obvious that theater owners are fearful about changes in the streaming world. Do you think there's a broader concern among studio executives, among producers, that their old way of doing business is changing and Netflix is as much of a threat as it is an ally?
Yeah, I think there's a concern, but are they making the right moves to combat that? I'm not sure. You know, I would liken it sort of to how the traditional broadcast networks, your NBCs, your ABCs, your CBSs, have kind of flailed at the advance of services like Netflix or even premium and basic cable networks like FX or HBO. You would think that those major networks would be trying to create like attention-getting things that kind of cut through the chaff, like their own American Horror Story, their own Game of Thrones, and by and large, they're not. They're programming boring procedurals that are not really connecting with a young demographic or earning the sort of headlines as these other high-profile shows. And sometimes I wonder if traditional movie studios aren't following the same path. They're just doing the big things that traditionally work, you know, studio tent poles, the big comic book movies, but they're neglecting that sort of broad slate that people used to count on them for. And if you're resigning yourself to only making one thing, then it gets easier to dismiss you, I think.
I think there's one thing that we can agree on, and that is generally people should watch movies in movie theaters. Can't always be the case. But of all of the movies that are contending for Academy Awards right now, I can't think of a movie that deserves to be seen in a big theater more than Roma. What about you?
Well, I mean, you know, I know you're a Roma head, John, but I think a good example of what the theater can bring is something that we have in theaters right now, which is A Star is Born. Watching that movie and getting the same goosebumps and hearing people gasp or applaud afterwards or seeing their faces, just turning around and seeing how people react to a number like Shallow being performed. That's one of those things where the crowd experience and seeing these figures who are supposed to have the grandeur of icons on this gigantic screen, it just all works so indelibly. I'm so happy that I saw that on the big screen.
Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist for the New York Times. Kyle, thanks as always.
Of course.
Up next on The Frame, how Rami Malek's high school debate teacher helped spark his interest in acting. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. If you're an actor who's playing a real-life person, there's always the added pressure of getting it right. When you're playing Freddie Mercury, the world-famous rock and roll icon with an otherworldly vocal range and an amazingly flamboyant stage presence, that pressure is much, much higher. But actor Rami Malek was so ready to take on the challenge of playing the Queen frontman that he dove into preparation even before the role was his. That's also because his performance had to win over the surviving members of the British rock band who had final say on casting. When I spoke with Malek about his new film, Bohemian Rhapsody, we started way back with how his participation in the debate team at Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks led him to acting.
My parents were pretty intent on me being a politician or lawyer of some sort, possibly a doctor, but they thought debate would be a good way to go, and so did I. Well, I had a teacher who realized I wasn't very good at that aspect, but there was something called a dramatic interpretation, and as a teacher handed me a one-man show called Zoom In and the Sign, and I read it, And within a few hours, I was reciting it. It opened, "My name is Zooman, Z-O-O-M-A-N. I'm from the bottom." And I heard this voice come out of myself that I'd never heard before. I didn't know what was happening, but it felt special. I learned the whole thing as quickly as possible. And I went back to school a few days later, and I delivered it to my teacher, Lester Berry. And he's like, "All right, I think I'm going to enter you in a competition." And it was the first time I invited my mom and dad to anything, and they sat a few rows in, and I went to begin delivering this one-man show, and I saw, felt myself transform, and I saw them transform, and it was a moment of, wow, something special is happening between us that I've not known. It's been foreign to me before, and I liked it, and from then on, it was, where's drama class?
I want to ask you more about that idea of transformation, that in that high school performance, you recognize that you'd become something other than yourself, right?
Yes.
And any actor who is self-aware knows that that's like a secret to performance. Does it always happen at some point that you figure that you figured out the character, that the character has taken over you in some way?
It's a great question. I think I have been moments when I've been fortunate enough to show up on set and not have to feel like I've done all the homework the day before, so to speak, that something has already arrived and I've found something that has lent itself to a portrayal or characterization that is just going to carry itself without me. I'm just chasing it in a certain way. And when that happens, those are the best days. You just feel like you've found something, and it's living and breathing, and it's driving itself at some point.
Some actors find that a piece of wardrobe can be really important in transforming them. Sometimes it's makeup, sometimes it's hair. But I want to ask you about somebody you worked with on Bohemian Rhapsody, and that is your movement coach, Polly mm-hmm. Bennett, and about what she did with you and how that might have helped you find Freddie Mercury through physical movement.
Right. Well, all throughout, I realized, actually, in the very beginning, that I wasn't going to be choreographed. I would just be chasing Freddie. It would be an imitation, an impersonation, some type of mimicry. That's not what I wanted to do at all. It was very important for me to be as spontaneous as he was, not only on stage, but in every scene, to go in there and feel like my fellow actors were not quite going to know what I was going to do, that the audience in the concert scenes had no idea what was coming next, that I had the ability to interact with the audience in between takes as Freddie would. That, you know, of course, was a collective effort. It began with Jan Sewell, who is a master makeup artist.
She did your teeth and your nose and other things?
Yes, right? She did.
Have you forgiven her?
I needed the teeth. The teeth were something. That was a first moment when I thought, oh, I never thought I looked like him, but this is going to help. This is going to help immensely. It was something that Freddie was very insecure about, and I wore them from day one. I felt insecure, but I felt a little bit closer to him. She got me as close as she could, and then I would take the hair and makeup and go into costume fittings with Julian Day, and we would not only just wear the most audacious or ostentatious things, we would think what Freddie would think would be the best way to make a spectacle, what would flow on stage, what would have great reflection, what would enhance the concert performance. But collectively, more to your point, Polly Bennett was the person that allowed me to discover how he sat, how he moved, how he walked into a room, how he articulated himself while he was being a little bit more aggressive, when he was shy, how he would hold a cigarette. And then from then on, we would just slowly but surely study people who inspired him, Liza Minnelli, Jimi Hendrix, and David Bowie. But a lot of his movements come from Bob Fosse. So we spent a lot of time watching that. We would also take the lyrics of Killer Queen. And she would say, all right, you know these lyrics? I'd say, yeah.
She keeps them away, Shondo, in a pretty cabinet. Let them eat cakes, she says, just like Marie Antoinette. A building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline.
Say, now give me the soliloquy of a Killer Queen as performed by Marie Antoinette. And all of a sudden, I mean, you know those lines, and I'm not going to perform this now because it would be as embarrassing now as it was in the dance studio with Polly alone. But I did it over and over until I gave this Shakespearean performance, and I saw my body doing things that defied me as a human being. And all of a sudden, you see something that's very transformative and elegant and very regal, which he was. And, you know, there'd be other moments she'd be like, now just give me a cross-country ski across the room. And I'd say, what are you doing? But then you see that in the 80s, he's got a different kind of move. And, you know, we should point out Radio Gaga, these fists being thrown out into the air and, you know, question me, where do you think that's from? And it would take me a minute and I'd realize, oh yeah, he did boxing when he was a kid. He was a champion boxer. Even Brian May says he used to give me bruises. He would, you know, just give me a little jab every once in a while from a joke or from a moment of him just being elated, like, you know, that childlike mischief that he had.
When you were starting looking at Freddie Mercury's life, and the film reflects this, in the first, I think, 15 minutes of the movie, both when Freddie is working as a baggage handler and when he's performing for the first time, he is called a name that in the United States would be the equivalent of the N-word, the way that people, especially in the United Kingdom, address people who are from Pakistan. How did Freddie see himself as an outsider, as the child of immigrants, as somebody who maybe didn't feel comfortable in the way that he looked? Obviously, he's somebody who struggled with coming out as a gay man. How much of his worldview was shaped by other people seeing him as different and as outside?
I think an immense amount was shaped in that way. He was born in Zanzibar. He was put on a ship at a tender young age to go to school, boarding school in India. And had it not been a British boarding school named St. Peter's, he might have found himself in London at the age of 18, where he arrived with, you know, a very unusual accent, a man named Farouk Bulsara, who, you know, might have had an even tougher time becoming the Freddie Mercury that we know today. I mean, fortunately, he showed up and he had a very kind of RP royal pronunciation of the English language, and it was perhaps a bit affected to overcome, you know, certain obstacles of fitting in. He says it was an upheaval of an upbringing for him. He definitely did not fit in. His name was difficult to pronounce for so many, and he didn't look like anybody else, tell me. I mean, I'll tell you, he does not look like anybody else, especially if you look at those earlier pictures. Now, here's a guy trying to fit in, trying to understand who he is in this new world. And all of a sudden, he has to also deal with the sexual identity and the discovery of that at a time when being anything other than heterosexual is heavily stigmatized, not only by the, you know, the world at large, but his Zoroastrian family belief is something that they frowned upon immensely. So difficult to open up about any of these things. And the way I see it is, there is someone who wants to share what is burning inside of him. Not only the conflict, but the emotion, the sound, the movement. And it is at times violent, it is volatile. And when he gets out there on a stage, he lets it rip. I mean, he explodes like a fireball. That is Mr. Fahrenheit.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Rami Malek about playing Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind, the story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, now streaming only on Netflix.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The new movie Bohemian Rhapsody, about Freddie Mercury's life and his band Queen's rise to fame, is framed around the band's legendary 1985 performance at Live Aid. It's considered one of the best rock performances of all time, and it was the first scene that director Bryan Singer shot for the biopic. But it wasn't Singer who finished the film. While he's still the credited director, Singer was fired for failing to show up on set with a couple of weeks left in production. Dexter Fletcher was hired to finish the film. The switch presented a challenge for Rami Malek, who plays Freddie Mercury in the film, but Malek said the biggest concern for him was setting aside other people's expectations of what they thought a portrayal of Freddie Mercury should look like.
That was one of the biggest obstacles. I would say singing and that were the two biggest obstacles for me. Is, you know, everyone has a very particular relationship to him, and they identify with Freddie Mercury in their own personal way. So for me, I knew I was never going to appease everyone. And what I realized is, you know, here's a human being who appears to be superhuman at times, who struts on stage in a crown and cape. He's the closest thing we get to one of these Marvel characters. I mean, he's got the voice of someone who is not human, and he moves like no one you've ever seen before, and he transports you. What I tried to demystify about all of this is a human being and link my humanity to his in a way. And in doing so, I said, Rami, this is not someone that you need to fully attempt to embody. You want to understand him, you want to get as close as you can, but don't lose yourself entirely. And I think as actors, we're always trying to get so far away from who we are, but I needed to hold on to so many things that I understood about him that tethered us together, that was going to be an amalgamation of myself and him for every frame to feel as visceral and real as it could.
As an actor, how much do you relate to the idea that Freddie Mercury wanted to make sure that people who didn't have a lot of money, who may not have looked like everybody else, felt that they were included, that he was not judgmental in who he wanted to have admire him, and he wanted to make sure that people could see themselves in his performance, even if they looked nothing like him?
I mean, that was one of the aspects I truly did want to shine a light on and made sure what was encapsulated in this film. I think one thing that was beautiful about Freddie, and something that was really revolutionary, is just what you said. You know, he spoke to the outcasts. You never see him in performance really looking at the first few rows. He's always looking to the back. That's something Polly pointed out to me. She goes, look at where his eyes are going, to the end. He's trying to make sure everybody feels present here, everybody's sharing. He was a guy who refused to be marginalized into any particular category or segregated into any one thing. He didn't want to be labeled, and he didn't want anybody else to be labeled. He was defiantly appreciative of everyone being their most authentic selves. And as an actor, I look for projects that allow me to share that message. I think I do a show called Mr. Robot, where I think, you know, there's a young man who feels profoundly alienated by the world, and he's still attempting to save it in some way and have his voice heard. And I mean, between the two of these guys, I think they're sending a very clear and present message of inclusivity and acceptance.
Freddie Mercury, as a musician, and certainly Queen as a band, met with a lot of adversity, and they were incredibly optimistic about their abilities to overcome adversity. As you're performing that character and thinking about the way that they saw the world and the way they saw obstacles, how does that prepare you as an actor for adversity in production when you lose your director?
It prepares you very well, to be quite honest. I think getting myself to a place where I was ready to start with Live Aid and feel comfortable doing that, for me, felt like a feat. It was a moment I was very proud of.
Which was the first week of shooting, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. On day one, we started with that, and I felt I had overcome a lot of obstacles by that point. I had to get the approval of the band. They had the final say in who was cast. I had been putting in the hours with Polly and what, and I flew myself out initially without this film being fully greenlit to go work on singing and piano and movement. So I felt when I got there, I had a bit of a leg up. Now, there was always going to be catch up to play because it's Freddie and he is supernatural. But when we shot Live Aid, I knew it inside out, like the back of my hand. I sat down at that piano and it was a feeling like no other of seeing something you've watched over and over and over again. And here you are living it. But I knew where that camera had to go next at times. And I knew what shots we really need to pay closer attention to. So whether it was with one director or another later on, you know, working with Tom Siegel, our DP, was a relationship that I found very dependent on. And I think we were able to really help each other set up shots. It's another thing that I learned very well working with Sam Esmail on Mr. Robot with our DP, Todd Campbell. It's such an integral part of storytelling. I was at a place where I felt very confident and like I could take command of what I needed to do and what we collectively needed to do. It was a feeling I hope to continue to bring to projects as I proceed throughout my career.
Rami Malek, great to see you.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Bohemian Rhapsody is in theaters now, and that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Kavanaugh, and our engineer this week was Sean Campbell. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here on Monday.